Okay, so because of the maka of Choshech last week and our inability to have to learn together, I want to try tonight to really put the basics of what I wanted to focus on last week and what I wanted to focus on this week together. We'll see where we end up. Could be we just stick with last week and briefly mention this week, but I think it all kind of comes together into one package, which goes back to the psukim that we talked about 2 weeks ago. Where we saw how, specifically regarding Pesach, as opposed to any other holiday, there's this idea of Chayav Adam Lirota Atzmoki Hulu Yatzim Yitzrayim, and an interest by Chazal and the Mishnayos to trying to have every person see themselves as if they were experiencing Mitzrayim. So we asked, where does that come from? Meaning, why don't we have this concept in any other mitzvah? Why is it that specifically regarding the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziyah Mitzrayim and our goal on Seder night, did we understand that to be something that has to be more connected to our experience, either connecting back to, you know, what it would have been like to be there, or right, pretending that we are experiencing a similar type of thing today? Where does that come from? And we saw that if you look carefully in the Psukim and Shmot, the Psukim emphasize a lot the day of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, the Laila and the Yom and Hayom Hazeh, and the questions that people are going to ask, that your children are going to ask by Yom Ahu. And so, and the Torah is particularly concerned about how you convey a all-powerful, sweeping experience, which was Yitzhak Mitzrayim, to future generations of people who didn't see it. How do you make them feel that they were part of Bayom Hazeh? And if we suggested that if you focus on the day as opposed to the event of Yitzhak Mitzrayim, as opposed to the fact that we left, instead to remember Zachor at Hayom Hazeh, so when we're talking about remembering the day, that broadens our memory to go beyond just knowing that something took place to experiencing it. Because when we remember a day, that involves a lot of different aspects, and it pushes us and forces us to kind of imagine the different components of that day, what we were wearing, what we ate that day, the weather outside, meaning the environment, the atmosphere, and kind of the context plays a critical role. And I think that that's part of the basis for why, when it comes to the night of the Seder, our interest as a whole is not just on remembering something, knowing it cognitively, but in creating a more all-encompassing experience.
So you're saying something like, oh, you could talk about something just objectively. Oh, these were the events of 9/11 versus where were you on 9/11? What was...
Right, tell a story about the day. If you're telling a story about the day as opposed to a story about what happened... Right, so the day, the story about the day, exactly, that's also what we emphasized. It becomes something that's much more personal, where you have to place yourself in it and talk about your role as opposed to just things that are happening external to you. And that may be the basis for kind of needing to frame Yitzhak Mitzrayim that way. So what I want to try to show tonight is, how did Chazal take that idea of Ki'ilu Hu Yatzam Mitzrayim and the Hayom Hazeh, right, that the Torah seems to emphasize, and turn it into the Seder that we know it? And I think that there's a tremendous amount, and we'll really just touch the surface tonight. But you know, this is my area of passion in terms of thinking about education and goals of education and the experience of education. You know, these are the things that I like to think about, probably too much. But I think that Chazal, in many different ways, were very 21st century or progressive, right, in the way they were thinking about the type of ways we tell stories and the type of experience we're trying to recreate. And while I'm not sure that there's one clear conclusion, there are certain elements of what Chazal are trying to do on the night of the Seder that really highlight their educational goals and kind of the way we're supposed to look at our educational goals when it comes to passing down belief in God and the fundamentals of faith that Yitzhak Mitzrayim represents to future generations. One of the questions that really progressive school on the West Coast that I am obsessed with called High Tech High. So it's a project-based learning school. And one of the...
presentation on that.
Yeah. And one of the one of the questions they like to ask whenever they're interacting with teachers and trying to understand kind of goals of education, think a little bit bigger picture, is asking if you remember a moment of yours, an experience of yours, or a learning experience in high school or beyond. I guess maybe what they, the way they phrased it is, describe your most impactful learning or learning experience. So when people describe that or tell that story, usually it's much more about, right, the person who was there, the context, the atmosphere, what was going on. Right, for me, I remember the first time I was asked the question, I remembered, you know, a sicha from Rav Lichtenstein in Gush on the first night of Yom Kippur, my first my Shana Aleph in Yeshiva. Rav Lichtenstein, kind of cloaked in white, big white yarmulke, gets up on the on the shtender in front of the whole yeshiva, starts swaying back and forth, screams on the top of his lungs a pasuk, and I could not tell you what he said after that. Right, I couldn't tell you what the content or the substance of the sikha was, but what made the learning 20 years later, right, impactful, what I remember is the experience. What I remember is the way it was framed, the context, the person, the people who were involved, and the story that was told, around it. And I think that one of the questions that we struggle with a lot as educators and as teachers is how much are we trying to simply create experiences for our students, for our children, for ourselves and our own learning? And how much does the content or the literacy, the information, the knowledge that we're trying to impart also play an important role? Where exactly or how exactly do we find a way to, on the one hand, right, use experience to make things memorable, to create engagement, right? But engagement for the sake of helping people remember the substance, the content, the ideas that it is that we want them to remember. And that's something that's very challenging, right? So I think that part of what Chazal understood is that if you want people to remember a story and understand the story, the way in which the story is told, the atmospherics of the story, the way it's framed, the context, what's going on around it, right, is just as important, if not more important, than the particular content that you choose. And we may get a chance at the end of this year to look at, you know, is there particular content that you need to say altogether? What are some of the elements that Chazal felt were critical when it comes to what we're saying on the night of the Seder? But the first thing that we see connected to this idea of Chayav Adam Liras Esatzmo Ki Lo Yatzam Mitzrayim is not, therefore you have to say certain things, but therefore you have to act in a certain way. So what I want to start with is by looking at the two things that at least the Rambam claims is a direct result of this idea of needing to view yourself as if you're a slave in Egypt or as if you were freed, right? To understand the different goals of those two particular elements, namely the mitzvah of aseba, of leaning, and the mitzvah of dalakosot. I want to try to show how those two mitzvot really are meant to frame our experience and impact the way in which we relate to the Seder as a whole. Right? And then hopefully if we have time at least a little bit to delve a little bit into, well, what exactly are we supposed to be talking about? Which is that we know how much the Seder means to us, right, from an experiential perspective. If I were to ask, you know, you guys to remember, to share what makes your Seder memorable, right? So it probably is not going to be, right, the amazing Dvar Torah that, you know, your child repeats every year, the same one or the same questions or the question that was asked. Probably has more to do with certain customs that were passed down from family members about a weird way to sing a song, a weird way to spill wine out of cups, certain custom, how to sing Chagadya, right? It's much more about kind of the customs that are inserted in the way in which we perform, we do the different parts of the Seder. Then that's part of what makes the experience so memorable to us.
It sounds like what you were saying about the shiur with Rav Lichtenstein, or his that time when he was addressing you guys, was really about the emotional tenor and the intensity with which he was of his presence.
Correct.
At that moment.
Correct. Absolutely. You know, there was very much focused on the persona.
You said it was Sikh of Yom Kippur.
Yeah, it was Yom Kippur night. Again, that's also the context of the atmosphere, the fact that there's, you know, you're talking about a packed Beit Midrash with a lot of people and a certain intensity that's there. But I
there's a different feeling of the Seder.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Of course, it's the context is different. But what I want to try to look at together is whether or not, right, the context or the framing that we're trying to create is simply to bring people in so that they pay attention to the content, or is there some inherent value and message that the framing and the context is supposed to provide that makes it intrinsically meaningful on its own. So so the Rambam in the first source. In discussing the obligation to view yourself as if you left Mitzrayim, so the Rambam says, and in every generation, as if he himself now left Mitzrayim. And we pointed out last time that the Rambam, as opposed to the Mishnah, focuses on laharos, on demonstrating to yourself, as opposed to seeing yourself, and seems to focus much more on ata mishibim, on what you're experiencing now, as opposed to kind of projecting what it would feel like to be back in the past. Separate point. Then he continues to say, in Halacha Zayin, next one down, I thought that I would save pages on the source sheet by making the sources a little bit smaller. It didn't help. It would have filled the same box anyway. I don't have that on my printer at home. But it would have filled the same box anyway, and now I just have to require you to strain your eyes a little bit. So I apologize for that. So in Halacha Zayin, the Rambam says, Lefika kishisoi radam balayla zatzarch lecho velishtos v'hu mesiv derech eris. Therefore, because the goal is to view yourself as if you're free, so then what do you need to do? When you eat the night of the Seder, how do you have to eat and drink? You have to lean in the way of free people. And also, and everybody, whether you're male or female, you have to drink 4 cups of wine. So according to the Rambam, what's the way in which we demonstrate that we view ourselves as ki'ilu ata yata mishiba mitzayim? How do we do that? What does he say we need to do to demonstrate that?
And practically, recline and drink darbukosa.
Right, so practically, it's reclining, haseba, and dalakosot, which he describes as doing it derech cheros. Right, that somehow these two actions of haseba and drinking dalakosos somehow are an expression of my viewing myself as if I am now free, as if I am cherut. And that makes it like showing I'm appearing to be, right, as if now I am acting as if I left Egypt, or as if I experienced what they experienced in Egypt now. So somehow Haseba and Dalakosos is meant to be a way of demonstrating a feeling of freedom. The question is, where exactly does the Rambam get this from? And how much does, right, the emotional aspect and the goal of the mitzvah of Haseba and Dalakosot in terms of trying to make me feel like I'm free impact the way in which we do these particular mitzvot? Right, so we want to understand what exactly or how exactly do these two mitzvot of Haseba and Dalakosot help me feel free and experience or express a sense of freedom, right? And also, right, how does that play out, or does that make a difference? Does that goal make a difference in terms of when, who, how, why, you know, all different aspects of how you do the mitzvah? So some of those details we won't really focus on. We'll try to focus on the fundamental issues, and then if anyone wants to look more, there's a bunch of different places I can send you to. So the Mishnah introduces us to the 4 cups and to leaning in a little bit of a backwards way. Right? It doesn't say that everybody needs to lean. Right? It doesn't say that when you come to the night of the Seder, everyone must lean and they must drink four cups of wine. The way the Mishnah describes it is, afilu ani shebiyisrael lo yochal sheyesev. Even a poor person is not allowed to eat on the night of Seder until they do haseba, until they lean. Vilo yivchasu lo, and that poor person also shouldn't have no less than four cups of wine, afilu min atamchoy, even if he's being fed by the soup kitchen. Sounds like the Mishnah is telling us a chiddush here, that even a poor person has to do haseba, and even a poor person has to make sure that he has dalei kosev.
And it's telling us this before it's even established that we have these requirements in general.
Correct. Right? This is the way it's introducing to us that there's a need to do lean at the Seder, and that there's a need to drink dalei kosev. So why choose to introduce this halacha specifically when by expressing that even a poor person has to do it? Why would I have thought that a poor person is different?
He doesn't feel free.
Why doesn't he feel free?
He's strapping around for money and his circumstances. So.
Okay, so is it that overall he doesn't feel free? Meaning that he is somebody who can't experience, can't act. This act is not a demonstration of freedom because there's just so much more going on for him? So Tosfos says something a little bit more specific than that. It's not just his overall state of mind, but his overall state of mind and kind of wealth or lack of wealth impacts what the act of haseba means to him, what the act of leaning means to him. Mm-hmm. Says Tosfos, the Sal Kadaitecha might have thought, Te hasebas ani lo chashiva haseba, te ein lo amala haisev, ve ein zed derecheros. That yeah, a poor person can lean. Mm-hmm. He can physically do an act of leaning. Mm-hmm. But that's not going to be derecheres. That's not going to be a demonstration of freedom. Because for him, he can't really do it in a way that manifests in the same way that wealthy people lean, or in the same way in which people have couches and they lay back and they enjoy themselves. Right? Very famously, Rav Yoel ben Nun is known for writing about Haseba. Rav Yoel ben Nun is a big Tanakh scholar in Israel, who, besides being a Tanakh scholar, is also very, very much a spirit of the law, halachist. Meaning he is very interested in making sure that we're not just keeping the details of halacha, but we're maintaining the spirit of halacha. So for example, right, he believes that he is pretty well known for putting tzitzis on his suit. Right? He has custom-made suits, or he has the suits cut, so he puts the tzitzis on his...
Does he also do blankets and towels?
Maybe, but... He doesn't really wear blankets and towels, but he's saying that a suit is a chashev, is a significant baguette, so he wears it. And he also is famously believes, and this is more controversial on a halachic perspective, that nowadays you should bench if you eat a full-fledged satiated meal, even without bread. A paskening like one of the yachid in the Gemara and Bracha, but he says v'achalta v'savata. So if the savata nowadays doesn't have to involve bread, we can't. How could you not make a bracha namazah? Those are just a couple of examples. So he has a long article on haseba where he talks about how he thinks that the way to do haseba nowadays is for everyone to go into the living room. I don't know if how much. My mom certainly did not like this idea when my dad got into this, had to do this, right? That everyone should move away from the table, go into the living room, put their feet up on couches, right, and lean, because that's the way in which, right, wealthy people have living rooms, they have drawing rooms, they, whatever you call, the British people, right, they have separate rooms where you go to relax, and that's a sign of wealth. It's not something that we do in the context of the meal, but we still do have that way of demonstrating comfort and wealth by being able to have a different place in which we're going to sit as we talk to each other. And so he would go in for Magid to his living room. So everyone would sit on couches, put their feet up, come back to the table for the Suda, and then go back to the living room for Hallel.
Uh-huh.
And we'll see why the Hallel and Magid kind of go together.
With what you said about the benching,
mm-hmm.
Is he saying it's different today because we
people are satiated, and yes, more protein, more. Uh-huh. Meaning just the habits of what we eat. Meaning
I mean,
people.
They always ate bread back then. Right?
Yeah, people have fancy meals, and they are traditionally they often get full even without bread. Mm-hmm. Nobody really agrees with him, but it's just an indication of how he's so focused on the spirit of the law and what the Torah is trying to accomplish. Uh-huh. So how does that play out here? Right. So again, the Tosos is explaining that we would have thought, if the Mishnah didn't tell us, that a poor person doesn't have to do Haseva, because a poor person doesn't have anything to lean on, and therefore he can't, or right, even if he has something technically to lean on, it's not Mechubad, it's not Chashuv, it's not something that's significant, and therefore it's not really, his leaning is not a demonstration of freedom, and therefore it's pointless. Question now is, what happens when in the bottom line we say that a poor person still does need to lean? So what are we changing? Right, if at first we thought that the goal of Haseba is to experience freedom, and that if you aren't experiencing freedom or a free way of acting through your Haseba, then you have no obligation to do it. And a poor person, when he does Haseba, is not really experiencing freedom. So one could argue that when the Mishnah says that a poor person needs to lean, what is the Mishnah teaching us?
Meaning, could be teaching, that's not what leaning's about. It's not that you need to do a dersha, something else, something other technical.
Good, right, maybe the Mishnah's teaching us that we got it wrong. That this action, the ideal and part of its institution is about feeling free and acting like free people, but it's not about my emotionally right now experiencing or feeling an experience of freedom like the Rambam made it sound. It is more about doing a symbolic action that is commemorative of an action that people took earlier on. Rashbam calls it, not Derech Eirut, Rashbam calls it in the next source, right, as a commemoration for freedom. Meaning it's not about making sure that now, in my own context, I'm feeling the experience that was felt then. Mm-hmm. It's about taking me back. It's about doing actions that may not have meaning or significance in context now, but remind me of experiences that happened a long time ago. And this is something that, you know, when we think about it, when we learn Tanakh, it's important to connect ourselves to the stories of Tanakh, really in both directions, right? To be able to translate the values and messages of the stories to our own experiences nowadays, but also to put ourselves in their shoes and understand their context and understand the story from within, imagining what it would be like to be a Jew at the time of Yetziat Mitzrayim or an Egyptian at that time. Both of those things are valuable, and I think that's part of what this tension of Derech Eirus and Zecher L'Cheirus, that's coming out of the mitzvah of Haseba. So there are a number of different implications to this question.
You could say that alternatively, it's not saying that it's just Zecher L'Cheirus, but it is about having that emotional experience. But there's a certain expectation that even if he doesn't have that thing to lean on, he's capable, like we say by Sukkah, with the Avil, by Le'Yisuvi Daite.
Good. He can still experience that. Meaning just because he doesn't have something to lean on, or just because he's overall poor, doesn't mean he can't pretend. It doesn't mean that he can't, like little kids play dress up and little kids imagine themselves to be all sorts of different things, right? Meaning we can create experiences that put people in a certain frame of mind, right? Even if it's not the ideal way of them doing that, or it's not a function of the reality for them. And that very well could be, and that's probably the way the Rambam understood it, who really emphasizes this idea of Derech Eirus and Kilu Ata Yatsim Yimitzayim, and the need to re-experience it. One of the most interesting nafgamino to this question that Shlomo Zalman Orbach says or makes the connection of is, he says, might the goal of Haseba be different nowadays right, than it was in the time of Chazal. The Ravya is famous for saying that there is no Chiyav HaSeba Bizman HaZeh. The Ravya was a German Rishon living in the 12th, 13th century. And he was looking around him and said, nobody leans the entire year anymore. Everybody sits on chairs. That's the way wealthy people eat. So to go and, you know, do one of these things where, you know, you lean to the side, that's not derech eretz, that's not freedom.
It's in and
that's a joke. That's like ridiculous. So he said there's no mitzvah to do it anymore because it doesn't accomplish anything. So that makes a lot of sense if the goal of the mitzvah is derech eretz, and now it's not an expression of eretz anymore, so it should fall away. And if the mitzvah is about a formal obligation to do an act that commemorates or symbolizes events of the past, so then I could say that no, the mitzvah should still apply. So that's kind of the basics of or the basic question when it comes to Haseba, the idea of leaning, right, being a way of expressing freedom that frames our evening, because every time we eat or drink on that night, right, it's not just, or we're talking about whatever we're doing on the night of the Seder, we're doing it in a framework of feeling free. Right? Haseba doesn't impact what I'm saying, what I'm thinking, or other things that I'm doing or eating. Right? But it creates a certain framework, it creates a certain context, it creates for a lavish atmosphere, right, where it feels like everybody's just lounging around and acting like wealthy, free people who can enjoy themselves. We might say, that this too is part of the goal of having lots of wine on the night of the Seder. And when you think about a meal with wine versus a meal without wine, so why, you know, what changes when you have wine in a meal?
More relaxed.
Hey, people are certainly more relaxed. But even while it's more relaxed, also, right, if you're going to have a fancy party, right, there's an assumption that there's going to be alcohol, that there's going to be an open bar, or whatever it may be. Right, I made sure that my students, you know, even though they knew what an open bar was, and, you know, that wine and drinks make an event fancier, right, that all they had so far were Shirley Temples, right? That was their, you know, remember the bat mitzvah, whatever. I don't know, ginger ale, whatever you have at a whatever non-alcoholic beverages you have, but we certainly recognize that the association of wine with a meal makes it fancier. We also know that the association of wine with mitzvot, it makes those mitzvot more significant. We've been talking in the shiurim that we've been having, chaburs that we've been having earlier in the year, we were focusing on the mitzvah of Kiddush. Right? And we talked about the idea of saying Kiddush al kos. And why would it be that either midaraisa or midrabanan, we want to connect Kiddush to a cup of, to reciting it over on a cup of wine? And it's interesting because the Rambam, right, connects the mitzvah of remembering Yitzhak Mitzrayim to the mitzvah of Zachor Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, and says that just like every Friday night, right, we have a mitzvah of, or every Shabbos we have a mitzvah of Zachor Yom HaShabbat L'Kadsho, so too on the night of the Seder, we have a mitzvah of Zachor HaYom HaZeh Asher Yitzhatem Mitzrayim. So what exactly is this parallel, and why is it that on the Seder night, it's not just one cup for Kiddush, but it's four cups? So we saw the Mishnah before that introduced us to four cups back, kind of backwards from the poor person. The Gemara on Kuf Chedor and Beit in Pesachim on the second page quotes a Braita. It says, "I'm going to read Michael."
Tana Rabbanan, the rabbis taught Hakol Chayavim ba'arba kosos halalu. Everybody's obligated for these four cups. Echad anashim vecha nashim vecha tinokos. Whether it's men, women, or children.
What's strange about that?
The children part.
Right. So asks Rabbi Yehuda.
I'm Rabbi Yehuda. V'chi matuos yesh l'tinokos b'yayin. What purpose does it serve for kids?
Why are they drinking wine? That's probably not such a good idea.
Yeah, I would think besides for what purposes it served, it's, you know, little kids usually aren't chayav in mitzvah, so that's another strange thing about
it. So it's not clear whether or not it's babies or whether or not it's...
somebody who's Magil Chinuch.
Magil Chinuch, maybe, or maybe Gadol, right? That's a younger child. Fine, okay. But it's interesting, right? What you're pointing out is it's interesting that Rabbi Yehuda doesn't say v'chimachi of yesh l'tinokos, right? Eich mechayv in tinokos. His question is not about that. His question is about mato elas yesh l'tinokos b'yayin.
It's purpose and function,
right? Which implies, right, that yayin is not just about a formal act or mitzvah of drinking. It's achieving a certain toeles. There's a certain goal. There's a certain experience that it's creating, which we might have thought to include tinokos in. And the truth is that one of the other times in which Mishnayos and Braisot, they talk about being mechayiv tinokot is in the midst of hakel, right, where they talk about, the psukim say, right, that who is chayiv? Anashim, nashim v'taf. You should bring to Hakel men, women, and children. And so the Gemara in Chagiga asks, right, why are you bringing the children? So one answer is, right, just to give reward to the people who bring them. But still, it's a strange way to like them. Why describe it that way? So there are many who claim that when the goal of the mitzvah is the experience, right, and the communal experience that we're having, everybody together, so then it makes sense that children should be a part of that. And so maybe, right, Rabbi Yehuda's question is assuming, right, that Dalet Kosot, the mitzvah of Dalet Kosot, is not just about the wine, but it's about the experience, right, the framework that the Dalet Kosot create.
Do you think it might actually be saying that the children don't literally have to drink it? In other words, that the term arba kosot here really refers to being present and awake for magid.
Could be, right? Let's look at the alternative, right? And yeah. What you're saying is going to fit very well with that. Chimato alas yesh b'yayin. What purpose is there to wine? So what's the answer?
Mechalkin lehen klayos ve'gozin ber pesach. So what should you do rather for these children? Don't make them drink their four cups of wine. Give them nuts and other kinds of foods on their pesach. K'dei shlo yishanu. This will keep them up. B'yishalu. And then they'll ask
curious.
Questions.
So it's a bit of a strange answer.
Yes.
Meaning, okay, it's like saying, well, if they can't daven, then we should at least have them do chesed. Like, they're both good, nice things, but why? How is one possibly a replacement for the other? I can understand why it's important to engage children in wanting to be up for the story. But what does that have to do with Dalet Kosot? I mean, how is that a replacement? Okay, they're not going to drink wine, so instead of wine, give them klayav agozim. What it seems like the answer of the Gemara is suggesting is what you were saying, that it's not about the wine per se. Yeah, okay, fine. They won't benefit from the wine. So we need to find another goal, another way to accomplish what we wanted to accomplish by having Anashim, Echad, Anashim, Nashim, and Tinokos involved in the Dalet Kosot. What is that goal? The goal is
keep, right, them up.
To engage in the Seder, right? To recognize the key components or the different parts of the Seder, ask questions, be cognizant, notice what's going on, and be aware and be curious about it. And that's very different than what we would have thought Dalet Kosot are about. So when the Gemara reaches this conclusion, there are two ways to understand what it's telling us, both of which I think are really interesting. One might be that the goal for children at the Seder is different than our goal for adults. The goal for adults is ki'ilu hu yatzim mitzrayim, to feel as if they're free, to re-experience tziat mitzrayim, and to connect to the ideas of the Seder that way. Tinoko children, we can't really get them to feel that experience. They're not cognitively, they're not emotionally mature enough. So what do we want them to do? We want them to watch us see what we're feeling and be curious about that and wonder about that and ask questions about ourselves and what we're doing and what we're experiencing. Meaning their role is not to do or experience the same thing that we're experiencing. It's to connect to or notice the experiences that we are having. And that I think, you know, is interesting in terms of Higata Levincha and the different questions and the role of the father in terms of Manishtana. You know, what exactly do we want the children to do? Right? Do we want them to have the same experience that we have? Or perhaps, as Gemara is suggesting, right, we want them simply to be engaged, to ask questions, to notice, but to notice what we are doing. And that's kind of a more of a modeling type of idea in terms of how we're educating, right? One of the key challenges in education is that the depth with which we are able to experience things as adults can't possibly be transferred to children who are not ready for that yet, who don't have the same ability to understand and appreciate that. So for them, right, we want them to do it someone on their own level, but we want them to understand or to see or to think about what we are doing. Alternatively, more connected to Talakosot, right, what the Gemara is saying, is that the four cups, really, we're misunderstanding what the Talakosot are about. The Talakosot are not about experiencing freedom. They're not about, you know, wine being a way of demonstrating, like Haseba was, just how free we are. Talakosot are about, right, framing the Seder. They're about getting everybody involved. In the same way in which Tinokos, we do that through the Klal Yisrael Gozim, with adults, we do that by wine, because everyone's excited about drinking more wine. So if we connect wine to different parts of the Seder, that's going to frame the key moments of the Seder, keep people involved and engaged, and make them interested in making their way through all the different components of it. This may be...
Maybe both are there?
Probably, yeah.
Yide Yayin, Yatza, Yide
Shir. Good, so that's what I think, right, the Brisker Rav, or Salvechik's uncle, talks about this, and it really seems to be pshat in the Gemara on Kuf Chadam Abayz, but we'll just see that in 1 minute. Before that, they really just two different clear indications of this. Ravina Mora describes in Kuf Chadam Abayz clearly, Arba Kozot Tavkinu Rabban and Darachirat, that the goal of the four cups, similar to what we saw in the language of Tosfot and the Rambam describing it, is to re-experience freedom, is to have that sense of experiencing freedom. Whereas Tosfos in Sukkah says, right, that women should be chayav in halal on the Seder night, a little bit of a different topic. But women should be chayav in halal on the Seder night. Why? Because they're chayav in dalikosot. And it makes sense that the only reason why the rabbis were metakin or established that we should have four cups of wine is to connect halal and haggadah to those, to have cups around them. Meaning, kiddush is something we would connect with wine any night. Berachat HaMazon is something, in many circumstances, we connect with wine anytime we bench or bench in a larger setting. So the interest in adding two more cups is to frame the night around cups of wine and to connect koso, dal koso, to halal and to haggadah. This is not so different from what we discussed a number of months ago regarding kiddush, right, where the idea of saying kiddush ala kos may be less about the wine as the beginning of the meal and what that represents, and more just about giving more significance and creating more excitement around a statement about the holiness of the day. Right? If we connect things to food, people are more interested, they're more excited about it. Right? And this is not true for me, but I definitely have friends who, you know, or know people who, for whom this is true, that when there's alcohol involved in something, that also gives it more significance and makes it something that people look forward to, makes it something that they pay attention to more. So similar to Kiddush, Tosfos seems to be suggesting that the goal of the four cups of wine, or at least one of the goals of the four cups of wine, is to create this framing experience, right? To engage by framing, right, how we're going to experience the various different aspects of the night of the Seder, and to give us something that itself may not be particularly intrinsically meaningful or connected to the substance of what we want to commemorate, but instead just gets us excited and engages us. Right? It's kind of what we like to call in education a hook. Right? Something where we're going to bring you in. Right? We're going to draw you in so that, right, you want to be part of the experience. And that's certainly a lot of what we're, you know, different components of what we're trying to do over the course of the night. I'm going to skip how this plays out in the Gemara in Psachim Anko Chedem Beis. The Gemara seems to basically talk about both of these different components by talking about Yedei Cheret, right, there being a component of the obligation which is about freedom, and a component of the obligation which is Yedei Yayin, or Yedei Arba Kosot, really more, right, which seems to be about actually having four cups. Right? The way this comes up is if you drink wine in a way in which you're technically drinking wine and you're having four cups, but it's not a freedom type of wine. So the example the Gemara gives is you drink undiluted wine, which is like kind of like drinking petel, right? Like drinking syrup, you know, or soda stream syrup, right? So right? Gulp it down. So you're drinking wine. You're having four cups. You're organizing the Seder and giving structure to it and framing to it, but you're not drinking it in a way that actually is a free, wealthy type of way of doing so. You could say that you're also not doing it in a way that people are going to be excited, but in terms of technically framing things, you're still doing that. On the flip side, the other thing that Gemara talks about is what happens if you drink them all together. If you go, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, chuck them all down, right? Do you fulfill your mitzvah? So in terms of creating an atmosphere of freedom and being in a relaxed mode, so you've done that by drinking four cups of wine. You drink a lot of wine. In terms of structuring the Seder, you have not really accomplished that. So that's kind of how Dalakosa, I think, plays out as this type of framing. I just want to say 2 minutes on the substance. Right, and I think it's interesting to think about. I don't have a clear answer, but I think it's interesting to think about, right, whether or not, you know, it certainly seems like the goal with the Dalakosot and the Haseba is to find ways that have us do these experiences at particularly critical moments on the night of the Seder. For Haseba, it's about when you're eating and drinking, when you're eating matzah, or when you're drinking Dalakosot, perhaps even according to the Rambam, when you're eating Shulchan Aruch, when you're engaged in the meal on the night of the Seder. Dalakosot seems to be more connected to substantive pieces of the Seder, though. Right? Less about the times when I'm eating and doing physical actions, right, eating and drinking, and more about framing, right, the things that I'm saying. Kiddush, Haggadah, Birchat HaMazon, and Hallel. Right, so the two unique parts of that to the night of the Seder are Magid and Hallel. Right, and while we often think about Hallel as being separate of Magid, there's a lot of indication, it's really its own sugya, right, that Hallel is really just an extension of Magid, of the mitzvah of Sipur Yetziyah Mitzrayim, that the Hallel that we're reciting on the night of the Seder is really part of how we are remembering and telling the story of Yetziyah Mitzrayim. Indeed, if you look at the way the Rambam describes what we're supposed to do, so this is a part of the Rambam that Rosenzweig liked to quote a lot. So in Aleph, the Rambam says, "Mitzvah Seh Shal Torah, l'saper benisim v'niflos, shenasu la'avoseinu b'mitzrayim b'leil chamishasar." So according to the Rambam, what's the goal of the mitzvah? What are we supposed to be highlighting? What are we supposed to be emphasizing? According to the Rambam,
the miracles that happened
to our forefathers. Right? It's not telling the story of us leaving, or even of the mitzvot. It's about the miracles that God did for us. If you look down at the end of this halacha, he says, he adds, not just if you talk about anything, but if you talk about the events that occurred, then, right, this is praiseworthy. Rosenzweig, a number of Pesach Pesachs that I had the opportunity as an Ishir to visit used to emphasize this halacha a lot in saying that all of these, like, you know, the Russian Exodus Haggadah, the Israel Haggadah, the Women's Rights Haggadah, the Civil Rights Haggadah, right, all of these things, right, are diluting the one of the core aspects of Sipur Yetziyat Mitzrayim, which is to focus on the Dvarim She'iru V'Shehayu, the things that occurred, the Chorat Asherah and the Nisim V'Niflos, that happened B'Leil Chamishasar, on the night of the 15th. It's interesting that the Rambam right here focuses very much on the narrow, even not just on miracles, but on miracles that occur on the night of the 15th. It sounds like, according to him, the real focus should be just on Makas Bechoros. Right? So the Rambam, when he starts to describe what it is that we're supposed to remember or I'm supposed to be talking about, has a very narrow focus in thinking about the actual substance and details of what happened on the night of the 15th. Why? Why would we want to talk about history or talk about these miracles as a key component of the story? What do you think would be unique about that? Or why would talk, or how would, right, having to tell the story of what happened be important? Why not just jump straight to, right, like we kind of do a little bit in the Haggadah, to V'ilu lahotzi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Avosteinu B'Mitzrayim Hari Anu B'neinu B'nei B'neinu M'shivu Adim, you know, meaning jump to the implications. The Rambam seems to be saying that before you can think about the implications, you've got to really dig deep into what actually happened. You got to start by connecting to the story itself. Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Then the Rambam will skip halacha bet, halacha gimel. Hey, look, also here he says it again. The second line down in the halacha gimel, he says, right, that the child asked, "Man shana alai lezem mikali lot v'yomer lahem kach v'kach ira v'kach v'kach haya." Right, emphasizing that same language again, that the following happened and this is what occurred. And then in Halacha Dalid, he starts to give us more detail based on the Gemaras. V'tzarech l'hachil b'gnut u'lisayim b'shvach. You have to start with bad and end with praise. Right now, we're not just talking about events and history describing facts. What are we talking about here? If we're describing it as gnut and shvach,
their opinions, perspectives.
Right, it's a perspective or an evaluation of the event. It's not just telling a story. Now we're broadening a little bit and talking about kind of the implications or a judgment or an evaluation of the story. So how do we do that? Matchil Masaper Betchila Hayu Avosinu Bimei Terach Umulfanav Kofrim V'Tom. So we should first start talking about Terach and start talking about how our forefathers were idol worshippers, and then you conclude with Bidat Ha'emet Shekirvanu Hamakom Lo V'Hivdilanu Mina Umas V'Kirvanu LiYichudo. Here we're not talking about Mitzrayim at all, or events that occurred in Mitzrayim. We're talking about philosophy. We're talking about faith. We're talking about how we used to not be believers, and now Hashem helped us become believers. And here we're conceptualizing the events of the night on a different kind of level. We're not just talking about Masha Ira and Masha Haya. We're also talking about, right, the Dad HaMS and how we moved from being disconnected from God to being connected to God. Where does the Gemara, where does the Rambam, where do we get this from? How is this connected to the Nisim and Islal Shanasu Lavosena Bimitzrayim Balel Chamishasar? Why do we broaden it beyond just talking about the miracles on the night of the 15th? So I don't know. I'm not sure. But I think that maybe it's part of this idea of Zachor Hayom Hazeh Asher Yitzatem Mitzrayim. Right? And there's an understanding that before you can broaden, or before you can, right, start to think about implications or the bigger picture, you got to know the facts. You got to describe the story. You got to talk about what actually happened. But if you just talk about what actually happened without thinking about the implications, without making it part of a broader picture, then those events can't lead to an appreciation of amunah, an appreciation of Hashem's role. It can't lead to not just the sipur, but to the halel. If the ultimate goal is that understanding the story and appreciating the story leads us, that the ultimate goal is that through seeing ourselves as if we were part of Egypt, through remembering the story, we now recognize just how much we have to thank and praise God for everything that we have, then that means that we have to go beyond. And I think there's you know more to think about and talk about in terms of this, but I'll stop here. It's interesting, right, to think about kind of the different debates in the Gemara and the different ways in which we broaden the story. We broaden the story from a Emunah perspective to talk about how we used to not worship God and now we do worship God. We also broaden the story from a Yetziyah Mitzrayim perspective, that we don't just start with going down to, as slaves in Egypt, but we start from Arami Oved Avi. We start from Lavan, and we start from Bris Bein HaBesharim, and we try to broaden the story to recognize its broader context within the history of Am Yisrael. And I think that that's also one of a key way of moving or of shifting education from just content to meaningful content, right, and to something that's much more experiential, is to help students and to help ourselves see the broader context. The broader context from a, you know, what really led to this and what were really the implications of it. And the broader context from what did this mean in terms of who we are as a nation, who we identify as, what our relationship is with God. So I think that, you know, starting to think about that is also critical. And the last piece, right, is halacha hey. Right, the third thing, besides telling the story, broadening the story, and the two different ways we do that, the third thing is, right, how we relate to objects, right, props that are part of that story. Right? The need to have Pesach, Matzah, Umaror, but the need to talk about those props. To have formal mitzvot, right, which is a large part of Judaism as a whole, that we, you know, turn things into actions, into formal activities. But on the night of the Seder, in the same way in which we're broadening the story by talking about the bigger picture, we also broaden our perspective on the actions that we do on the night of the Seder by having to explain them. Because if all you do is eat Pesach Matzah Umaror without talking about, right, Lechem She'onim Alav Dvarim Harbe, without talking about Al Shema, what does this come from? What is this for? What is this meant to accomplish? So then you're missing the goal of the Seder night, right? Going back to that, turning Hayom Hazeh into Bayom Ahu. If the whole purpose of the Seder night is to reconnect lots of generations and kind of create this unity of generations amongst Am Yisrael, where even though we live thousands of years after Yetziyat Mitzrayim, we can still connect back to what happened there and see the implications of it on us today. So Chazal are teaching us a number of different ways in which we can go about and do that. We can go about and do that through Haseba and Dalakoso by creating a framework, by creating an experience. And we can do that by what we choose to focus on and how we tell the story. By not ignoring the details of what happened, and telling and filling in the nuances and the details as much as possible to kind of have that vivid picture, but not just stop there, to broaden that vivid picture to a broader appreciation of where this fits into the historical and theological context of things, and to connect that to physical actions that we're doing and see how the story and the meaning of those stories is actually a reason why we do the things that we do today, thousands of years later. So I hope that, you know, that kind of that really, really broad overview helps give some broader framework to what we're trying to accomplish on the night of the Seder, and hopefully can give us, you know, even more things to think about as we see how those details play out in the Haggadah itself on the Seder night. Thank you.